ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It was a revolution where barely a shot was fired. Nuns armed with rosary beads helped lead millions of Filipinos in peaceful demonstrations. 40 years ago this week, they brought down the dictator, Ferdinand Marcos. So how critical was the Catholic Church, especially its leader, Cardinal Jaime Sin, to the people power revolution? Filipino historian Dr. Jethro Calakdai is currently with Cambridge University.
Ferdinand Marcos, as president of the Philippines, ran the country under martial law. He called a snap election in December of 1985 to prove to the people that he still had legitimacy as the president of the Philippines. So the candidate of the opposition was the widow of Marcos's top political opponent, Benigno Aquino Ninoy. The widow, Corazon Cory Aquino, was convinced to run against Marcos because Cory had the ability to unite the opposition. So by February, when the elections were already happening, there was massive fraud, vote buying, intimidation, and violence. Election returns were tampered with. There were two tallies that were taking place at the same time. One was the official government tally, the Commission on Elections, that show that Marcos was winning, while there was another citizen-led tally, which is the National Citizens Movement for Free Elections, or NAMFREL, which showed that Cory Aquino was ahead. By February 9th, the 35 computer workers of the COMELEC Tabulation Center walked out to protest the fraud in the elections.
Yeah, and Jethro, yeah. I have to say, I will never forget, I think I was in my last year of high school, I will never forget watching on television those brave women, little women, they were short women in white coats, walking out.
Yes, and actually that was a momentous occasion because this was the official government tally. For them to have that courage is very inspiring. These women, they were brave, but also they were afraid for their safety. They sought refuge in the church. So they went to the Redemptorist Church in Baclaran. But some of them, to evade harassment by the goons of the government, they went to the Cenacle Retreat House in Quezon City. The next momentous occasion was February 13. When the Catholic Bishops' Conference of the Philippines issued a strongly worded letter condemning the results of the election.
Yeah, I think they used the word evil, didn't they? They said what the Marcos regime had done was evil, the Catholic bishops said.
Yes, yes. This statement was worded in that way because lots of sources were saying that it was written, drafted by one of the bishops, a Jesuit bishop by the name of Francisco Claver, who was a bishop in Mindanao in the southern Philippines. In fact, Bishop Claver was the first Igorot bishop to be consecrated in the Catholic Church. So the Igorots are an indigenous people, an indigenous ethnic group in the northern Philippines. Bishop Claver became a Jesuit, and because of that, by this time, he was highly involved in protests against the regime. And so Bishop Claver wrote that statement in a very strong language. The reaction to that initially, before it was released, was that Imelda Marcos was actually trying to convince the Cardinal Archbishop of Manila, Jaime Sin, to stop the pastoral letter from being released because pastoral letters are read on the pulpit. And so people are going to hear it, not just read it, but they're going to hear it. But the cardinal said, I'm just one vote in the conference of bishops. I'm not as powerful as your husband.
Yeah. Well, we're going to learn, though, just how powerful Cardinal Sin is. But on the 22nd of February 1986, the Defense Minister Juan Ponce Enrile and General Fidel Ramos, the head of the National Police, break away. They say that they are no longer loyal to the regime. They've only got about 300 troops with them, and they're holed up in two camps, Camp Crame and Camp Aguinaldo. And it's on either side of this major highway that's running through Manila. It's called the Epifanio de los Santos Avenue. That's where we get the nickname EDSA. What threat did they face from the regime?
These men are not nobodies. They're quite high up in the regime, especially Enrile. Enrile was one of the really solid men that surrounded Ferdinand Marcos throughout martial law. In fact, he was part of that staged ambush that supposedly pushed Marcos to declare martial law in 1972. But at this time, the threat was real because the regime saw this as mutiny. If you use that word, if you use that term, then the state had the capacity to suppress rebellion. So Marcos was already preparing troops to suppress Ramos and Enrile. Mm.
So facing that threat, these two very senior figures who've broken away from the regime, someone very significant comes to their rescue. Who is it?
Yes, and the person who saved them was Cardinal Jaime Sin, the Cardinal Archbishop of Manila. Enrile called Cardinal Sin. The request was quite vague. Enrile was asking for moral and spiritual support. But then what Cardinal Sin did was to call on the people and religious groups through Radio Veritas, the only radio station at that time that was functioning and was not under the control of the regime. Cardinal Sin spoke through Radio Veritas, calling the people to protect Enrile and Ramos, to provide them with food, to provide them with support. And in the course of doing so, they were to stop the armed forces from suppressing what the government saw as a rebellion.
Yeah. Yeah. And it wasn't just Cardinal Sin, though. Hundreds of thousands of Filipinos flooded into the streets of Manila. But I remember this so well. Tell us about those extraordinarily brave nuns. There were nuns on the streets. They were kneeling in front of tanks. How important were the nuns?
The role of the religious at this moment, their role at that time was really almost like a human shield. They were in front of these tanks, these guns. They were praying the rosary. Some of the people brought their statues of the Virgin Mary out into the streets. They were praying, they were singing, trying to stop the armed forces from doing what they were set out to do. And also, it was some sort of campaign to arouse the conscience of the armed forces. If you see the footage of the EDSA revolution, you will hear chanting. People were shouting, "You are also Filipino." They're shouting this to the soldiers in order to stop them. So I think these brave nuns who went out there really was engaged in this campaign to arouse the conscience of the soldiers. But previously, consecrated people were already working very hard and very bravely to help the poor and as a protest against the regime.
Yeah. This is the Religion and Ethics Report with me, Andrew West, here on ABC Radio National. We are reliving the momentous events of almost 40 years ago, the revolution that toppled the Marcos regime in the Philippines and the crucial role that one particular cardinal and hundreds of nuns and priests played, along with, of course, hundreds of thousands of ordinary Filipinos. I'm speaking with Dr. Jethro Calakday. He's a Filipino historian. He's currently at Cambridge University. Jethro, we shouldn't have been surprised, though, by Cardinal Sin's decision to call the people out to help topple the regime, because even though he wasn't necessarily an outwardly radical figure, he had been speaking out for some time at, I think, probably some danger to himself, hadn't he?
Yes. Cardinal Sin was the Archbishop of Manila in 1974, so 2 years after the declaration of martial law. And initially, he assumed what he called a stance as a critical collaboration. That was a very particular term that he used. Critical collaboration with the regime. He was not going to call for toppling the regime or ousting Marcos or more radical demands like that. He was going to be involved in good governance to the best of his abilities, but being critical, meaning that he will call the regime out when he sees that it was contravening certain moral issues. This was a controversial stance to take because for a lot of activists in the early years of Cardinal Sin's tenure in Manila, it seemed that he was not doing enough. So he was criticized for not doing enough. On the other hand, there were people who were saying that he was dabbling into politics too much and he should stay away from politics. In the same year, in 1974, something changed. The Sacred Heart Novitiate of the Jesuits in Novaliches was raided by the army, supposedly because the Jesuits were harboring political dissidents. This angered Cardinal Sin very much. He spoke out against the regime, not just personally, but I think there were reports that he was speaking against, you know, he was expressing his outrage against the raid on the novitiate in the pulpit. Another turning point for Cardinal Sin's overt intervention in the protests against the regime would be in 1983, after the assassination of Benigno Aquino on the 21st of August. Cardinal Sin was the one who presided over the funeral of Ninoy Aquino. The funeral was a very brave demonstration of solidarity with the Aquino family, but at the same time, it was a demonstration, a brave demonstration against the regime.
Yeah.
2 million people flooded the streets of Manila to bring the coffin to the cemetery. And Cardinal Sin was the one who presided over the funeral. That is a very significant moment.
Yeah, I remember about 5 or 6 years after the revolution, I was a very young newspaper journalist. I met Cardinal Sin. I was so entranced by his warmth and his humility, but he also had a good sense of humor because the last thing he said to me at the end of the interview was, "Pray for me because my last name is Sin."
Yes, and he would often joke about that. He would welcome guests into his house. Welcome to the house of Sin.
Jethro, we should talk, of course, about President Corazon Aquino. I know that her government did not turn out to be everything that the reformers hoped it would be. But this was a very brave woman who stepped up after the regime had murdered her husband. How central was the Catholic faith to Cory Aquino's identity? How important and central was her religion?
So Cory Aquino was a very pious woman. She was raised in a very traditional household in which girls were sent to convent schools. In fact, she went to the Benedictine-run St. Scholastica's College in Manila. So she was very pious, very involved in religious activities. So faith was very central to Mrs. Aquino. But I would dare say that her status as an elite brought in complications to her tenure as president. When we are talking about the EDSA revolution, we are not really just talking about a radical transformation of Philippine society. Mrs. Aquino comes from the landed elites of Tarlac. Her family was involved in the land labor dispute in Hacienda Luisita, which did not end well for the tenants of that hacienda or estate. She definitely believed in social justice. This was a woman who listened to the bishops, who listened to the teachings of the church, especially after Vatican II. But her background complicates that picture because she is still part of that economic elite in the country, in a country in which poverty was natural. You know, we shouldn't be talking about poverty as something natural, but it was natural. it became naturalized for Filipinos to speak about poverty. That's just how the way it is, as people in the province would say. And so her administration, Cory Aquino's administration, was marked with discontent because there were coup attempts against her administration, some of which were led by former allies. There was also the lost promise of economic prosperity. A lot of scholars would talk about the failed promises of the EDSA revolution. People were expecting a radical change in their fortunes, but a lot of people saw that they remained very poor. This was a problem that not only the Cory administration faced, but all the administrations after the EDSA revolution faced. So what is the promise of EDSA?
Yeah.
Did it deliver?
And here on the Religion and Ethics Report with me, Andrew West, here on Radio National, I'm speaking with Dr. Jethro Calakday, a Filipino historian currently at Cambridge University, and we're telling the story of the Filipino Revolution 40 years ago and the critical role that the Catholic Church played in that event. Has the Catholic Church in the Philippines become more radical since the hopes, so many hopes, of the EDSA revolution had been dashed?
Yeah, that's a very important question. And allow me to broaden my answer. The role of the Catholic Church in Philippine society has always been central. From the 19th century, at the birthing of Philippine nationalism, in fact, a lot of scholars would tell you that the birth of nationalism, or even the beginnings of nationalist consciousness, began with issues within the church. In the revolution against Spain, clergy were at the forefront, not only in rallying the people to the cause of the Philippine nation state, which was being birthed at that time, but also some of them took up arms, becoming commanders of guerrilla units. By the middle of the 20th century, and of course, in 1986, when the Catholic Church was again at the forefront because of the EDSA revolution, we see here not some sort of jack-in-the-box moment in which the Catholic Church suddenly became radical. No, I would say that the Catholic Church was always there and was at the forefront of momentous milestones in the life of the Philippine nation. Has the Church become more radical? It depends on what radical means. What I see is that the church is a powerful institution. It has the confidence to speak its mind on issues that it deems very important, not only for them as a church, but for Philippine society as a whole. This logic of intervening in social and political issues became much more pronounced after Vatican II. Because the church became sort of had the ammunition, for a lack of a better term, in Gaudium et Spes, the constitution of the role of the church in the modern world.
Well, Jethro, how influential is the church today in the Philippines?
Today, I cannot say that the influence of the church is as strong as it did before, okay, in that very long history. For one, in 2012, with the debate on the reproductive health bill, the church lost that debate. The bill was passed despite the vehement opposition of the church. Now, the church continues to lobby against measures like same-sex marriage, divorce, and abortion. But I think it is losing the battle because a lot of the younger generation are attuned to developments in the West. But also on the darker side of things, the church has lost influence in 2016 at the election of Rodrigo Duterte. Now, Rodrigo Duterte is a figure not liked by the church. He has criticized the Catholic Church and the bishops and the priests, etc. The church has spoken against the war on drugs, extrajudicial killings. But then you see a lot of support for Duterte in 2016.
Yeah.
Now that begs the question. And in 2022, although the church did not have a candidate in 2022, a lot of clergymen and religious congregations were supporting Lenny Robredo. But then Marcos Jr. won the election overwhelmingly.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is, too, of course, the Catholic Church in the Philippines faces competition, I guess, from evangelicals and Pentecostals. We think of the Philippines as a strongly Catholic country, and it still is, but it doesn't have the field to itself, does it?
That's correct. Although the Philippines is still 80-something percent Roman Catholic, you have a lot of these new religious groups, movements, and Protestant churches. The most significant politically is the Iglesia ni Cristo, the Church of Christ, which a lot of politicians court for their support because the Iglesia ni Cristo practices block voting. The executive minister dictates who the members of the church will vote for. And so a lot of them really want the endorsement of the Iglesia ni Cristo. In fact, Rodrigo Duterte was endorsed by the Iglesia ni Cristo, and so was, I think, Ferdinand Marcos Jr. in 2022. There are other religious groups. There's one in Mindanao called the Kingdom of Jesus Christ, whose founder, Apollo Quiboloy, is being pursued by the law for human trafficking cases. There are other religious groups, Pentecostals, etc. But yes, these are groups that are competing for space in politics.
Yeah. Just finally, Jethro, would the people power revolution, and ultimately it was those hundreds of thousands of people on the streets of Manila who toppled the regime, but would that people power revolution have succeeded without the voice of Cardinal Sin, without the nuns kneeling in front of the tanks saying the rosary, without decades of the Catholic Church's quiet radicalism? Would it have succeeded?
It's hard to tell, but I am sure that the Catholic Church played a decisive role in bringing an end to the regime. As I said, the nuns in front of those tanks praying the rosary, that's just the tip of the iceberg. A lot of these nuns, religious congregations of both priests, brothers, and nuns, they were working with the poor. A lot of bishops, even before Cardinal Sin, they were working with the poor, organizing indigent communities. It was all leading to that. This was sort of the high moment. But if you ask me, the Catholic Church really played that decisive role at that particular moment. There was really this meeting of all these conjunctures, for lack of a better term, in which the intervention of Cardinal Sin was most propitious.
It's been very good to speak with you. You mentioned, by the way, the role of Radio Veritas in amplifying the voice of Cardinal Sin, urging the people onto the streets to help topple the regime. Radio Veritas was destroyed at one point, and a couple of years later, there was a rather moving song that was a huge popular hit called A New and Better Way that came out to help raise money to rebuild Radio Veritas. Dr. Jethro Calakday, he's a Filipino historian. He's currently at Cambridge University. Thank you very much for retelling the story of the Philippines Revolution 40 years ago.
Thank you very much as well.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.